Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
This is a special hour of Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and we are bringing you a full hour with some wise voices on history today. The question before us, what does history teach us to expect from 2023? Radio Boston is incredibly lucky to have some remarkable students of history in the neighborhood, and we're excited to have several of them for this conversation. Michael P. Jeffries is the Dean of Academic Affairs and a Professor of American Studies at Wellesley College. Kelly Carter Jackson is an Associate Professor of Africana Studies, also at Wellesley College. And Carrie Greenidge is an Assistant Professor in the Department of Race, Colonialism, and Diaspora at Tufts University. Michael, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Kelly, great to have you.
My pleasure.
And Carrie, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
All right. So if we're going to ask what history tells us to expect from 2023, we should probably start with some reflection on 2022. Mm. So producer Amanda Beland has put together a bit of a retrospective for us. We've got a couple of these we'll use over the next little bit. Here's the first. And a note to all listeners. Some of this sound is from difficult events of 2022. And so listen with care.
New details today after police arrested more than 30 members of a white nationalist group in Idaho. Officers confronted the Patriot Front group on Saturday. Dozens were piled in the back of a moving truck.
Doctors at Mass General Hospital are treating the first case of monkeypox in the U.S. this year.
As we've been reporting, 21 people died in Uvalde, Texas this week in the shooting at Robb Elementary.
More than 2 months, brave Iranians of all ages and walks of life have been taking to the streets calling for freedom, equality, and the end of Islamic rule.
Queen Elizabeth II, Britain's longest reigning monarch, has died at the age of 96.
James Webb is seeing the distant parts of the universe in a wavelength that has never been seen before in this clarity.
And Webb's first official deep field. A patch of sky absolutely packed with galaxies.
Bill Cosby is officially a free man. Pennsylvania's highest court threw out the former comedian's sexual assault conviction.
Just to remind our viewers what we're seeing right now, Harvey Weinstein convicted of 3 of 7 charges here in the Los Angeles trial.
Former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin was sentenced on federal civil rights charges today in the murder of George Floyd.
I spoke with the family of Breonna Taylor this morning. They were informed that the Justice Department has charged 4 current and former Louisville Metro Police Department officers with federal crimes related to Ms. Taylor's death.
Judge sentenced a white father and son to life in prison and their neighbor to 35 years for federal hate crime in the 2020 murder of Ahmaud Arbery.
The Select Committee to investigate the January 6th attack on the United States Capitol will be in order.
So it's a lot. And by the way, we're going to bring you a lot of sound throughout the show today. At the end of the show, we will give full credits for everything that we've brought you sort of audio today. So, Kelly Carter Jackson, I'll start with you. If there was a theme or a sentence or a mood for you that would capture 2022, and that's just a smattering of this last year, what would it be?
Exhaustion. I was exhausted listening to that. It's 2022 has been a hard year, and that's kind of unimaginable coming off of 2020 and 2021. I feel like we are in this long, expansive year that just feels like, you know, event after event, or death after death, or shooting after shooting, or, you know, trial after trial. All of that. I think people are burnt out socially, politically, economically. And I think that all of that soundbite really encapsulated those feelings of just weariness. There's only one thing that sort of brought a smile to my face was the exploration and the galaxies. And
it's the James Webb telescope.
Yeah, but it's like, but that's not this world, you know, like that's not where we live. So I would hate to think that the only thing that would lead us to be hopeful is something that is not of this world.
And yet?
And yet, I still have hope.
Good.
And yet, I tell people all the time, I can't not have hope. I have children. So I'm always hopeful. I do believe that 2023 can get better. I do believe that progress is always possible, but struggle is hard, and we need to be reminded that the work is constant.
So, Carrie Greenidge, I'll turn to you next. Was there, and again, that was one smattering. In a few minutes, I'm going to bring you a second smattering, right? But in that one, was there a moment that either was, for you, was like either A, wow, I completely forgot that even existed in the world and happened, or B, yeah, that's 2022 for me in a nutshell.
I think the event that encapsulated 2022 in a nutshell for me was the headline on the tragedy in Uvalde, which to me, we seem to be going through and having the replay of these events constantly. And I think that it's, Kelly used the term burnout, and I think it is the burnoutness that we feel when we hear about tragedies in Uvalde, but then we don't respond as a society should respond to get rid of these things. But I think that kind of encapsulates this never-ending kind of Groundhog Day feel, that until there's sort of fundamental changes, we keep having the same the repetition of these similar tragedies that occur. I will say that the other thing that struck me was the protests in Iran, which not that I had forgotten them, because I've been reading about them and following them actually, but that was a bit of brightness of hope within sort of this morass of craziness and violence and unrelenting keep on doing the same thing over and over again and expecting different results kind of moment that I believe this country is in. So seeing people actually protesting always, it could always warm my heart in a way that I'm even surprised at when mm-hmm. it starts to warm my heart in a way. So I think those two are what struck out for me. And one thing that Kelly said is this exhaustion. I think there's this collective idea of burnout. I think there's this collective moment that we're in 2022 where people are tired, and but I still manage to have hope, as Kelly's saying. You know, I have little people in my lives as well, and you have to have hope when you're around younger people, and they're very inspiring. So I think those are the two moments that stuck out for me in that clip.
So Michael Jeffries, I'm going to play another tranche of 2022, and then I'm going to reflect with you on it. So let's just hear a little more of what producer Amanda Beland has put together for us.
Today, the Omicron variant represents a new west-to-east tidal wave.
In the early morning hours of Thursday, local time, with as many as 150,000 Russian troops surrounding the neighboring country of Ukraine, Russian President Vladimir Putin made a televised address.
More than 60 million people across the country will experience temperatures over 100 degrees. Heat advisories going up all over the place from Texas throughout the South.
Let's look now at what Brittany Griner could be facing, even as the U.S. government continues to negotiate for her release in a prisoner swap.
As we gather to celebrate the confirmation of the next justice of the United States Supreme Court, Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson.
Let me just repeat that, because this is a huge moment for the United States. The Supreme Court of the United States has overturned Roe versus Wade.
After a chaotic 48 hours, the nearly 50 Venezuelan migrants flown to Martha's Vineyard by Florida's governor are back on the road.
So, Michael, one of the things, we did a conversation with comedians reviewing the end of 2022, and one of the songs that came up was, "We Didn't Start the Fire," that feeling, you know, Billy Joel.
Man, 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 man.
So as you listen to these two montages, is this a sense of, man, there is just nothing new under the sun? Or is it a sense of, wow, what an unusual and unprecedented year?
I think there are certainly some things that are unusual and unprecedented about it, right? I mean, if you look at the scale of the pandemic, for example, and the fact that we're still grappling with it, that seems to be unusual and unprecedented. And I think for many of us of a certain generation, the kind of sense of authoritarianism on the march around the world feels new and unprecedented. It feels more immediate, perhaps, than it had felt before. So those are two things that really strike me. I mean, in listening to the clip, I think that's really what hit me about it is the first sort of group of clips that we heard really struck me as American problems, a set of American problems. The logic of American race was very loud in them. The gun violence in America is a very distinctly a kind of American.
Patriot Front, George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, Ahmaud Arbery, January 6th.
Yeah. Yes. And then in this group of clips, we heard some global problems that, of course, are connected to all the things we're dealing with here, whether it's migration, the climate crisis, authoritarianism, all of those things, right, are happening elsewhere. And we're dependent on so many people in other places to try to find a way forward, right? This notion that we're going to get out of it by ourselves, just within our own national borders, is a fallacy. So I think that's one of the things that struck me about what we just heard.
Yeah, I couldn't agree. I couldn't agree anymore. I mean, I think that we have tended to have this sort of isolation approach when we think about solutions, or a very arrogant approach that, like, only us can solve it. And and that's just not true. When you look across the pond, when you look all around the world, you see that these problems are interconnected. Whether we're talking about climate change and the environment. You know, I was in France when it was 106 degrees over the summer and with no air conditioning, and how just uncomfortable that feeling is. Or when you think about women's rights all over the world, or even when you think about the World Cup and just like how the world sort of comes together for support, but yet all of the political and social issues that came with that sport as well. There's so much that that brings about solidarity. And in that sense, that's a good thing. You know, we can all come to the table with these conversations. But man, we're definitely all in this together.
Jump in, Carrie.
Yeah, I'm nodding my head because I'm just thinking that, particularly with climate change and the heat and the 100 degrees and the fact that, you know, so much of this earth is becoming uninhabitable. It's becoming uninhabitable for people, for long swaths of time. And so the way that we're all interconnected, and then the way that we're interconnected through climate and how that feeds on, you know, the rise of authoritarianism, the persistence of authoritarianism, not that it's suddenly rising now, but sort of the persistence of it, and the ways in which all of these are connected, and that there's our tendency as Americans to be very isolationist, or as Kelly is saying, very arrogant. So you know, I listened to that last clip, and I'm thinking of the climate. I'm thinking of you know, the ways in which you know, there's not a solution that is going to save one of us without saving all of us. And conversely, we have to think along the lines of solutions that don't, you know, harm one of us. And we think of it, it's just going to harm one and not harm us all.
Yeah, no question. And, you know, I think that this is, I think this notion that we're connected to everyone, that we live in a global society, comes easier to some folk than to others. I really believe that many of the students that we have at Wellesley College, for example, really understand that intuitively because they've grown up on the internet with social media and the connections they're able to make across borders, space and time. It's just different than what many of us grew up with as children, certainly. So I think that some people really understand that. But even if you have that intuitive understanding of connection, the problems can seem so vast and intractable, right? These are global problems. I can see them, but how do I kind of make my inroads? And I think that's one of the great challenges for us as educators, is to give folks a sense of their agency and the ways they can empower themselves and build solidarity in a local space they're in the face of problems that are of a scale, right, that exceed any locality, right? I think that's kind of the real challenge that we have to wrestle with, is living in a global world, but giving people a sense of local and personal empowerment in the face of these grand challenges.
Yeah, I think this is why history is so important, because we can look at the past and really let it be sort of a roadmap for us. Like, I tell my students, you know, I study the abolitionists. They're like 1% of the population. And yet they're so instrumental in toppling the institution of slavery. 1% of the population, which tells me you actually don't need a lot of people to do really good work. I also think about the fact that, like, something like prisons or mass incarceration, prisons haven't been around forever, which means we can actually think about a world in which prisons don't necessarily exist. What are alternatives? How can we create a world that is not always based on what exists, but what hasn't always existed? So I think there are really good frameworks for being creative about the solutions that we want to see. And that, you know, inspiring a lot of hope, too.
We're talking about what history can tell us to understand about 2022 and expect from 2023 with Kelly Carter-Jackson, Michael Jeffries, and Carrie Greenidge. Carrie, I heard some assent from you there, so let me let you jump back in.
Yeah, I think one of the beauties of history is really being able to explore the ways in which historically we are interconnected. And, you know, like in my department, really stressing that, you know, the transnational and global aspects of everything that we study local, it seems like it's very local or seems like it's very localized. Kelly pointed out the abolitionists, you know, even when you're looking at people who, after the Civil War, continue to try to wage a fight against the violence and segregation that emerged in the United States and link that to struggles against, you know, developing autocracies across the globe. That's a historical lesson that I think we can take in this moment and look back on and apply some of those lessons and some of those ideas to the moment that we're in. And so history becoming a teacher, although it can't tell us, it can't predict the future, right? It can very much tell us the way that certain currents or ideas, what those can lead to. And also what kind of, it can give us hope because, again, that 1% of the population with abolition or the few numbers of people who could never imagine a world without colonialism and its horrors, right? In, you know, 1900, 1902, that they assumed that was the way that the world would always be. You know, we have the power to look back and say, you can create a world that you can't imagine at the moment.
We are reflecting on 2022 and casting our eyes forward now that we're in 2023 to say, what can history teach us about what to expect from the future? Still with us, Michael P. Jeffries, Dean of Academic Affairs and a Professor of American Studies at Wellesley College, Kelly Carter-Jackson, Associate Professor of Africana Studies, also at Wellesley College, and Carrie Greenidge, an assistant professor in the Department of Race, Colonialism, and Diaspora at Tufts University. So I would like to play some more sound, one more montage of 2022 that our producer put together that focuses a little bit more locally.
Governor Baker says the state is exploring the possibility of setting up shelters at Joint Base Cape Cod that would house the roughly 50 migrants from Venezuela who arrived on two planes sent to the island by Florida Governor Ron DeSantis.
More than 2,000 Starbucks workers at 112 stores are taking part in a nationwide strike right now. That includes one location in Gardner and six in and around Boston. One of those is the store on Commonwealth Ave. That's the same one where workers protested 24 hours a day for 64 days straight last summer and in the fall.
Democrat Maura Healey scored a decisive and historic victory last night, becoming the state's first elected female and first openly gay governor.
Healey led a slate of five women running for the state's constitutional offices, and all five prevailed.
The Federal Transit Administration concluding that the MBTA did not have their priorities in order, stating that they put more focus on long-term projects, which took away from daily operations and safety.
The goal of this 30-day shutdown of the Orange Line is to make the T safer, faster, and more reliable.
From an attack on a rabbi to Holocaust-related terms used by a high school football team, a new report showing a rise in anti-Semitic incidents in Massachusetts.
So Kelly Carter-Jackson, as I listened through that before the show, I was like, on the one hand, oh, we really had a different story in 20. No, we didn't. Yes, we really had a different story. No, we didn't.
It's like two steps forward and one step back. I was thinking of all of the different things. If I could add to that montage, I would say Claudine Gay is the first Black woman president of Harvard University. Like, that's huge. So there has been a lot of progress. But, you know, I tell my students all the time, progress is not linear. It's not just this constant march up the mountain to get to this utopic place. You know, it weaves and turns and there's downhills and uphills. And progress is also not inevitable. You know, the demise of slavery is not inevitable. The right for women to vote is not inevitable. That requires constant change, constant struggle, constant activism. So when I think about the Starbucks workers and how long they, you know, stood their ground on getting this union, that brings me so much encouragement. That really makes me hopeful. It takes perseverance and tenacity, but things are possible. Change is possible.
And that makes me wonder, you know, in thinking about it too, Carrie and Michael, it feels a little bit like, I don't want to say history repeating itself, but, okay, so when I was teaching in social work, in, 2013, 2014, when I was teaching, if I taught organizing protest unions, that was a history lesson, mm-hmm. right? By 2017, 2018, it was what my students were doing on Saturday when they weren't in class. And so we do have this previous era. Michael, we've talked with you in the past about the 1960s, right? The civil rights movement, et cetera. And I do wonder, is it a cycle? Is it a learning from the past? How to think about that from a framing, to put this in context? Do you understand my question?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I don't think it's a cycle, really. I mean, that suggests a kind of inevitability that, that Kelly just talked about that I don't really think exists. I think what it shows is the kind of brilliance and staying power of some of the tactics and principles of earlier periods of organizing, right? How do you build solidarity? What does it mean to set a target, right, and try to pressure that specific target? How do we think about political opportunity structure, right? These kinds of things, organizational and political history, those are lessons that can be lifted out of one historical period and applied to the next. So it's not that it's a cycle and it's going to ebb and flow and there's going to be a dip and then there's going to be a rise. It's that these lessons become relevant to the next generation and the generation after that. And I think what's interesting about the set of clips that we heard about in Massachusetts is, again, there's a sense in which we can look around the country and say to ourselves, wow, our state is in so much of a better place when you think about civil rights, the position of women in politics, et cetera, than so many other states. And yet, some of the fundamental challenges that you heard in that clip, challenges of infrastructure, public education and public safety, challenges of elections and fair representation in office. These are things that we have a responsibility, I think, as a state to continue to lead on and not just rest in our laurels and say, well, we have a woman governor, we have an openly LGBT governor now, we're good there. Or, well, we're going to fix up the tea a little bit and that's going to be enough for us. That's not really the answer here. Mm-hmm. The answer is, how can we continue to lead on these issues rather than being satisfied with where we are in comparison to some of our neighbors?
Carrie, go ahead.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with what Michael's saying and Kelly are saying. I think that we have an opportunity. I was listening to those, and all I could think was the opportunities we have as a state and as a Commonwealth to really create something that is different in kind of this times of 2022-2023 that can look different than other parts of the countries. And yet we also, you know, that clip talking about the rise in blatant anti-Semitism across the state and sort of the very, vocal, the way that is becoming more vocalized in large parts of the Commonwealth, you know, that's a sign that many of these currents are with us. And so rather than giving ourselves a pat on the back, as we like to do in Massachusetts after the last election, really saying that this is a call for us to continue as if, as if our lives depended on it, because they actually do. And we actually have to continue working from that place, as opposed to taking a sigh and saying, well, we're actually doing pretty well.
Yeah. I actually think that sometimes this is going to sound crazy, but it's like certain wins can be stagnating, because when you get certain victories, you think, oh, good. You sort of like pat yourself on the back, like Carrie was saying, and then we don't need to push on anything else, or we don't need to strive for anything else. And I think that constantly being reminded that, no, these challenges are ongoing, that one is actually not enough, that, you know, like if we've had, I don't know how many governors in the state of Massachusetts, then let's see if 10 of them can be women, or 15 or 20. Like, then it's a norm. One is not a norm. And so how do we actually shift the culture to that, so that those exceptions are actually a part of the society, not an exception to the society. Mm-hmm.
So there are three words that are kind of banging around in my head as I listen to the three of you. And again, we're speaking with Michael Jeffries, Kelly Carter Jackson, Carrie Greenidge here on Radio Boston, as we look at what understanding history might tell us to understand about the moment we're in and expect for the moments that are coming in 2023. And three words stick out for me, all right? Mm-hmm. And two of them you've actually said, and one of them you've implied. Mm-hmm. So the two that you've said are solidarity and inevitability, or lack thereof. And the one that's been implied is justice. And I'm really curious if you, so Michael, I'll turn to you because you're the solidarity came from you. I think I've heard you say it twice, I think, in this conversation. So where are we in those arcs, right? That arc of justice, that arc of solidarity in this moment and why?
I'll start with justice because I think that's, you know, that's one of the pieces that it's such a struggle to define it on a week-to-week basis, honestly. it truly is, in part because the scale of injustice, right? The more you investigate, the deeper the cruelty and the needless suffering appears before you. And you start thinking to yourself, what does true restitution look like? Mm. What does justice look like in the face of such cruelty, ignorance, etc.? That's a huge, huge challenge. I think that where we have to get to, honestly, when we think about justice is not thinking about justice as something that is administered by people in power. We need to start thinking about justice as something that is created, right, from the ground up by the people who are most in need of care, love, dignity, self-sufficiency, empowerment. And I think that's the power of this moment is so many of those kind of top-down wishes for top-down justice have proven to be insufficient for what we're really looking for, right? Which is security, dignity, et cetera, for everyone. We need to start thinking about justice more creatively. And on the solidarity piece, the other thing I'll say about, just really quickly on this, solidarity is a really powerful idea, but principled solidarity, not just solidarity because, right?
Because white supremacists are in solidarity.
Thank you, right?
Exactly.
Not solidarity out of habit or convenience or culture or a kind of mindless emotional attachment. Principled solidarity in the pursuit of something meaningful, in the pursuit of something valuable. That's the kind of solidarity that I'm interested in, and that's the kind of solidarity that can be lasting and transformational.
Carrie, Kelly, jump in.
Yeah, I would just say to add to that, I think also understanding that in the pursuit of justice and solidarity and these things, that the backlash is always going to be there, right? And so to have the idea that somehow we achieve, say, a goal or something positive happens, and then, you know, oh, that's a victory for us. It means that, you know, there's a very large element that is working against those forces of justice and solidarity and, equity for those at the bottom, and that those at the quote unquote bottom who should be leading sort of and taking control of these struggles, there's going to be a backlash against their very right to wage the battles for themselves and their good. So I think if we approach our goals in that respect, that the backlash is there, and it's every time, you know, the side of goodness and right and justice goes to the left, well, that means that the side of not of progress and backwardness goes to the left as well, right? Because they're it's constantly going to try to be a counterforce to the forces of justice and solidarity and progress.
So, Kelly Carter Jackson, that has me thinking of protests at Drag Queen Story Hours. It has me thinking of the march over the 4th of July weekend in downtown Boston. It has me thinking of the rise in anti-Semitism and the banner on the highway over in September blaming the Jewish community for 9/11. It has me thinking of a number of moments in Massachusetts. Which is interesting, again, that enlightened, right? Weren't we supposed to be the city on the hill in our state constitution? And, you know, at a place where we're proud of our institutions, and still Michael is saying, except you can't count on those for justice that has to come from the individual, and every step forward does create a pull.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the backlash that Carrie talks about is so central because it's a constant theme. In like every single political social movement, you will always have backlash, which is why when you have these major, let's just say political victories, like first female governor or first black woman president or something like that, there's always a weariness attached to that. So it's, oh, you're in danger, girl. Or like this idea that, you know, we have to make sure she's supported. We have to make sure she's protected because the position alone is not enough. If they cannot wield power within that organization, then it's meaningless, right? So to be able to just put a person or put a face or a person of color in a position and say, well, there you go, now you've got your black leader, that's not enough if they can't be effective. And then when they are effective, as Carrie was saying, there's always that backlash. And I think we grossly underestimate the backlash. Like,
yes.
January 6th is the backlash. And we grossly underestimated people's willingness to overthrow the government, right? To topple democracy. We laughed at them. We dismissed them. We said they're fringe, they're radical, they're crazy. But they were serious. And I think that that's something that we have to take into consideration, that these leaders need support. These people who are on the ground doing the work, they need support, not just pats on the back, hey, you did it. But what happens when you get there? How do you sustain that? Sustainability is key to progress.
Another example that comes to mind after your remarks, Kelly, is the Roe decision, which we talked about a little bit just a second ago. Right?
Yes,
was something that I think for many folk in my generation and older, it was truly unthinkable. And so much of the discourse around it before, you know, some of the most recent events was, well, they'll talk about unmaking Roe, right, overturning Roe, but they wouldn't actually do it. They'd have to be crazy to actually do it, right? That was the kind of assumption. And then, you know, the Supreme Court made the decision, and it was exactly what they said they would do, really, or is indicative of their entire career, those who voted to overturn it, what they'd been doing up until that point. So we shouldn't have been surprised, and yet it was just such a dramatic shift. And so even those battles that seemed like the battles of previous generations have kind of come back up again as central to this generation.
So what's fascinating, and I'll come back to you, Michael, and sort of give you the last word before we rest our voices for 60 seconds or so. As if we understand history, if we're students of history, and history tells us that's what was going to happen, you just said that, how do we get surprised?
Mm. Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, I think that in some respects, not everyone understands the history, right? So that's sort of cause for the surprises. You don't understand, right, the roots of the anti-abortion movement specifically, right, which grew out of, frankly, the roots of some of the white supremacist reaction to the civil rights movement, right, is around that same era. The color and tenor of that conversation changed dramatically in the 60s and 70s specifically. So if you don't really understand that history, it's difficult to understand how the kind of politics have aligned this way. So that's one thing. But then I think, you know, the other piece of it is, are we as a citizenry really engaged on a day-to-day level with national politics? I think that that's an important question for us to ask. And I'm not saying that every person has to be engaged to the exact same degree, because that's unrealistic. It requires time. It requires a level of privilege and education often to really understand these issues. But nevertheless, when you have so many different places to get your news, when you have so many different things competing for your attention, whether they're your job, your childcare responsibilities, whatever it might be, right? How much time do we all have to really see what's going on ahead of us, and where are we getting the information from? I think all of these things contribute to a sense of shock. How did we get here? Right? Because it's difficult to pay attention to all of these stories at the same time, especially in a time when we're already feeling weary because
exhausted.
Of the pandemic, because of racist violence, right? It's a hard ask to say, well, stay attentive, stay on alert, because things are unfolding in front of us.
We are in the midst of a fascinating conversation here on Radio Boston today with three students of history from local universities as we put 2022, which is behind us, in context and prepare ourselves for what to expect in 2023. With us for this conversation, Carrie Greenidge, who's an assistant professor in the Department of Race, Colonialism, and Diaspora at Tufts University, Kelly Carter Jackson, who's an associate professor of Africana Studies at Wellesley College, and Michael P. Jeffries, who's the Dean of Academic Affairs and a professor of American Studies at Wellesley College as well. I'm glad you're all still with us. So I'm going to be a little bit of a stinker here, Carrie Greenidge. I'm going to play you some sound of a person that you will recognize, maybe from this conversation we're having, on our air on December 29th, 2020.
A few weeks ago, I was telling my husband, like, I feel like I had nothing to watch on TV, and it was because the election was over, and I felt like so much of the past 4 years really had been the election. And so this is the first time I feel like politically things have somewhat slowed down a bit.
Okay, so Kelly Carter Jackson there talking to us a handful of days before the January 6th attempted insurrection in Washington, D.C. 2 years later, here we stand, and we think we understand that the three of you have just been telling us maybe we understand what's been happening. It depends on how well we understand what history should be teaching us about how to understand what's happening. So with all of that in mind, Carrie, what comes in the next few months? What is history teaching us we ought to be thinking about as we enter into this 2023?
It's a good question. And I remember listening to that show, Kelly, and being like, yes, she's right. Like, it felt like it would take a deep breath. And I think that, you know, this is hard. It's hard for everybody, right? And I think it's particularly hard because we want to have a feeling like we've reached a different plateau where the evils that have just occurred are somehow gone. And we all want that, and we all believe that. I think in 2023, what we have to keep our eyes open for is understanding that it's not behind us, understanding that look, the election in Georgia was too close for anybody to imagine that the election would be that close between those two candidates, right? We have Maura Healey as governor here in Massachusetts, and we wish her well, but I guarantee there's going to be immediate backlash to whatever happens with her administration, even within the next couple of months. And so I think we need to be open for that and take a deep breath and realize when that starts to happen, which it inevitably will, that we recognize it for what it is, and we don't entertain that it's something that it's not. And also, and this reminds me of something that Michael, you were saying earlier, also that we take seriously the threats to democracy, the threats to rights, the threats to you know, human autonomy and humanity, even as we think that they won't be taken that far. And I am one of those people, like you were saying, Michael, who was, oh, well, Roe won't be overturned, right? Even though I had many older women relatives in my family who were like, oh, yes, it will. They've been gunning for this forever. But I thought, oh, no, that can't happen. But I think we all need to take a deep breath and say, you know, if we know that the backlash is there and is already figuring out how to be its most backlash self, right? If we know, if we are in a moment where we understand that when people tell us who they are, as Maya Angelou says, believe them, then we have to try as we might. And as hard as it is, even for me as a historian and who's somebody who like thinks I know, and then I'm like, oh, phew, well, you can take a breather and then something else happens. You know, that's what we're living in, is this constant cycle of the backlash, and that is building. And so keeping that in mind as we move through 2023.
Mm-hmm. And so just a reminder for listeners, the Senate race in Georgia, Herschel Walker, Raphael Warnock, very, very close. Might feel like an eternity to go already, but that's the one that Gary Greenidge was referring to.
Yeah, you know, I resonate with everything you're saying, Carrie. It's funny, like, for me, I'm writing this new book, and one of the chapters I'm writing on is, like, joy. How do I find joy, make pockets for joy? Like, I took up kayaking, and it really makes me happy when I kayak. Just finding pockets to, like, to breathe, to think, to rest, to nap, whatever it is, to find the humor in things. I think one of the things I lamented throughout 2022 was this whole, like, conversation about the demise of Twitter. And even though Twitter is an incredibly toxic place, it was, like, my go-to for laughter. Like, when it came to Black Twitter, it was how Twitter was so spot on at making fun of pointing out, like, the absurdity of human life and people and culture and all of that stuff with a good meme or a good gif. And so I live for those things. That may seem superficial for someone else, but, like, I am living to fight for, in 2023, those small pockets, be it social media or just human interaction, in which I can find laughter and joy and pleasure, in which I don't have to be so wound up. That's a really hard space to be in, and I think that's what we've been in for the past 2-3 years, is this really wound up space, and I want to be able to relax.
Michael.
Yeah, I don't know that what I'm going to say is going to be so relaxing. So let me, let me apologize.
So get out your phone, Kelly, and get some Twitter ready. I got dog videos waiting for you.
Yes.
But I was reflecting somewhat on what Carrie said in the question you asked. And I think that in terms of keeping our guard up and why do we feel like we have to have our guard up waiting for the kind of the next assault or the next problem that we're going to face, I think part of the reason for that is even if we kind of knew all of the history that we possibly could, some of the things that we're dealing with now, these are institutional problems.
Yeah.
The institutions are the same.
Mm-hmm.
The cracks and the problems with our voting and election system are still there. And that's why you're seeing a little bit of it start to be addressed in this massive omnibus bill that we've heard so much about.
Yeah.
The infrastructure when it comes to healthcare in this country is still fundamentally broken. So, of course, we didn't have a great response to the pandemic. And, of course, it remains a public health crisis.
Yeah.
The climate crisis, right? We don't, you know, Boston has talked about some of the innovations that the city would like to make in preparation for climate change or in the face of climate change. But do we have a kind of national plan, let alone a global plan? Every time it seems like we're getting close to a kind of multinational agreement, it seems like there's one step forward and then two steps back at the global level. So I think that the reason for some of the anxiety around what might come in the future, even if we're in a moment of relative calm right now, is that the institutions that gave us so many of the problems we've been grappling with in many respects are still there. And I think that's really one of the next challenges we have to be able to field is not just sort of putting out the fire in an immediate political sense, like desperately winning a runoff election at the very last moment,
but thinking
about what is it about our voting system, our electoral system, that makes such a dangerous outcome so well within the realm of possibility, right?
Yeah.
What does it say that we don't really have a national, like, we don't really have time off for voting in this country. We don't really have
a
an easy,
for
right, an easy and automatic voter registration system. We don't really have, right, when it comes to federal politics, national politics, one person, one vote is not what we have in this country because of the Electoral College. These are institutional issues, and they're going to continue to produce massive upheavals and challenges when it comes to truly living out democratic principles and safety, dignity, et cetera, for every single citizen. So I think the institutional work is what we should turn our attention to.
So Carrie Greenidge, Kelly Carter Jackson, a listener is listening to this. They hear what Michael Jeffries just said. They say challenge accepted, right? The moment is to begin to fix these institutions. What here in the Commonwealth in 2023 does history teach us that are steps people can take to begin to create more just institutions in the categories that Michael Jeffries just laid out? Carrie, Kelly, whoever wants to go first, because that's not an easy question.
No.
Jump on in.
I always think that of acting very locally and beginning very locally in your town or wherever you are, you know, dealing with issues surrounding, you know, schools and this whole discussion we were having about, you know, students falling behind over the pandemic, which to me is just, it's so interesting to me that people kind of were shocked or appeared shocked by that, that notion. But, you know, volunteering in schools or seeing what do schools and places in your town actually need, libraries in place, what do they need? And starting very locally and just being in service of what locally is needed. You know, I don't have any children of my own. I live with a lot of children. but, you know, and I live in a suburb of Boston, but, you know, going in and saying, you know, what is it that this town actually needs right now is in terms of man and woman power, people doing the everyday stuff. And so I think that's a good way to stop. And you'll find that, you know, cities and towns are doing well, but they're struggling in terms of personnel. You know, the fact that we have teacher shortage and the fact that we have just a personnel shortage of ferrying people from one place to another. And so doing that type of work, this holiday season, you know, giving stuff to the hunger crisis that we have mm-hmm. in Greater Boston and Greater Worcester area. And, you know, immediately, you know, that's something that people can do very, very, if you have the means, you know, pretty easily, you know, making sure that you are donating to those places. So I think you can act very mm-hmm. locally and through that get like hack through some of the despair that can yeah. that is there very immediately yeah. right right where you are yeah. and so I would urge people, that sounds kind of like a hokey saying, but it really is no. like chopping through the local mm-hmm. stuff that is bearing people and cities and towns down.
I agree with that completely. I always say that, like, we don't need a bunch of leaders. We actually need followers. Like, people are so quick to, who's going to lead us? Who's going to lead us? And it's like, there are already people that are doing really yeah. great work. We need to find out who those people are, and we need to partner with them. And we need yes. to say, how can I help you? Because oftentimes it's very isolationist doing this kind of work. So having an army of people that will say, I will support you, I will come alongside you, I will donate a couple of hours a week to whatever that institution is that's doing mm-hmm. the work that you value. But I would say, even before you get to that step, maybe read, right?
Like, yes,
I think people are grossly either uninformed or
Amen.
Misinformed,
Kelly.
Right?
Yes.
Like, and reading for me is never a last step. Don't just close the book and be like, oh, well, that was good, and go to sleep. But, like, read the book. Get the information you know. If you can't read, listen. Love Audible. If you can't listen, watch. Love a good documentary, right? Like, there are different ways you can get access to information. I'm always listening to podcasts. I'm always listening to WBR. But, like, but I mean, get informed. Ask people who are informed, how can I help? Because I think, you know, you can actually do a lot of damage trying to help with good yes. intentions yes. without having information.
All right, Michael, exactly. Michael Jeffries, we're going to turn to you for sort of last comment on this thread, what you can do locally.
Yeah, I think, you know, my colleagues have already sort of outlined some of the things in terms of local public service. I would also add, you know, one of the ways that our lives are really organized is through professional affiliations, right? What is your job? What is your workplace looking like? So I talked about some of the issues that we see with respect to health inequities. I'm not a doctor. I don't really know anything about healthcare as a profession or as a calling for many people. It's more than just a profession for many people. But I do know that there are folk on the ground who have been thinking very carefully and forcefully about issues relating to inequality in the administration of care and mm-hmm. the threat that poses not only to those of us who are most vulnerable, but to all of us. Mm-hmm. So I think that in addition to, like, thinking about local politics and school boards and all those kinds of things, what is it in your professional community? What kind of work is going on in your professional community that you can tap into, as Kelly just said, and support and contribute to? That's another kind of way to get at some of these.
All right. And with that, Michael P. Jeffries is Dean of Academic Affairs and a Professor of American Studies at Wellesley College. Kelly Carter Jackson is an Associate Professor of Africana Studies, also at Wellesley College. And Carrie Greenidge is an Assistant Professor in the Department of Race, Colonialism, and Diaspora at Tufts University. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And that is it for our show. Today's conversation featured sound from NBC, WBZ, WCVB, PBS NewsHour, CNN, DW News, PBS Nova, Fox 34 News, KARE11, The New York Times, and The White House. And that's our show for today, folks. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR. I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.